keep crying and I keep not being able to sleep. And the only reason that I'm okay with moving forward is because it is the idea that this will never happen again. I'm holding on to that hope.
If it's what it takes, we will shame our national policymakers into protecting us.
I was in DC last week, and I'm hearing in the background all of these kids behaving like adults.
Parkland student, parent, and protesters, students across the country walked out of their classrooms to demonstrate against gun violence this morning. At thousands of schools, they marked 17 minutes of silence, one for each of the people killed in Parkland, Florida last month. Here in Los Angeles, public schools allowed kids to leave their classrooms and gather on campus. We sent Press Play producer Gina Pollack to Santa Monica High School, where more than 2,000 students gathered on the football field.
We stand with the victims.
We stand with the victims.
We stand with survivors.
We stand with survivors.
We stand with Parkland.
We stand with Parkland.
Against guns.
Against guns.
That's 15-year-old Roger Ghani leading the chants there. All the student organizers were dressed in orange, which they said is the official color for protests against gun violence. There were about 20 of them on a platform at one end of the field leading the walkout. At one point, a student in a blue sweatshirt jumped on stage.
Hey, the Second Amendment is a foundational part of the Constitution.
The walkout continued. Student leaders took turns reading the names and bios of the 17 students killed in Florida, holding up signs with their photos and the moment of silence. Many of the student organizers credited 16-year-old Melanie Porras with starting the movement on campus.
Honestly, there have been so many shootings that I was kind of just desensitized to this one until I saw the viral videos that were going around that students had posted where you could hear the physical gunshots and you could see bodies on the ground. And I thought to myself, after this, like, we can't just stand by idly. We have to do something because this is an issue that affects everyone. And that could be us one day. That could be my parent receiving that phone call that I've been shot dead in the hallway by someone with an assault rifle.
A lot of the students remembered the shooting 5 years ago right here at Santa Monica College. They've grown up doing lockdown drills. Some say they're now scared at school and that they react quickly to things like loud noises.
Even if someone like smacks their hand or someone's just yelling in the hallways, I immediately tense up and I start thinking, where do I go? Like, what's going on? Like, just get out of there.
Someone pulled the fire alarm. And I remember thinking to myself that, like, this was it. Like, this is how it ends. So I actually refused to leave my classroom because I didn't want to die. Well, it turned out to be nothing, but still, it was like that fear factor. And it was pretty crazy that I have to think to myself, like, you know, this thing that's supposed to keep me safe from fires could actually be the cause of my death.
That's Chelsea Moran and Melanie Porras there from Santa Monica High School. Their younger peers nearby at John Adams Middle School say that they, too, are afraid now.
It's something that I've been worried about for a long time. And sometimes in class, that is all I can think about, is if a shooter were to come into the school, is how I would be able to get out.
Eighth grader Ariel Candell.
My mom actually went to Sandy Hook Elementary School, so that hit pretty close to home. Also, this SMC shooting, also really close to home. And just because we are the students, we are the ones who need to be afraid. We are the ones who are being killed. It makes me feel empowered and confident that we can make a change and that our generation is the one who is going to make this change.
Voices of a few of the thousands of students across Los Angeles speaking out about gun violence and gun control today. Well, as students protested for gun reform today, some Republicans say there's a more likely culprit when it comes to school violence. President Trump, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and others say Obama-era guidelines aimed at helping schools cut down on suspensions and expulsions, are making schools less safe. Here is Marco Rubio speaking on the Senate floor about this.
Federal law appears to discourage school systems from reporting dangerous students to law enforcement. I don't support criminalizing all school conduct or school misconduct, but a student who has threatened violence, who has exhibited violent behavior, needs to be reported to law enforcement. A student that's committed a crime by issuing a threat of death using social media, that is a crime under Florida law. That needs to be reported.
Okay, we're going to talk about these Obama-era school policies with Susan Ferris. She's a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, where she's covered the school discipline process and its effects on children. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also joining us, Judge Donna Quigley Grohman. She's a Los Angeles Superior Court judge, and she previously served on the juvenile court, where she dealt a lot with this issue. Welcome to you.
Hello.
All right, Susan, let's begin with you. The Obama administration rolled out these guidelines back in 2014. And what was the problem that the administration was trying to address?
Well, the administration, the U.S. Department of Education primarily was looking at data that showed that there was a disproportionate rate of harsh discipline imposed on minority children, black children in very large numbers, and also on students with special needs. And there's a national database that's taken every other year from schools, and it showed that a few times. And so there was a developing concern about this. And this began outside of the administration. There was concern in Florida long before these guidelines came out.
Right. And Florida implemented its own guidelines similar to the Obama suggestions. So what kinds of examples were they citing when they came up with these guidelines? What did it look like to have this excessive discipline on campus?
Well, what they were worried about was data showing that black kids were getting, for example, referred to law enforcement, to police and courts at very extreme rates compared to other kids. For example, in the 11-12 school year, the data showed that black kids were, in Florida, let's take that as an example, were 23% of the student body, but 36% of the referrals to law enforcement. So there was concern like that. Disabled kids, 14%, and 19 of the total population of the school district, but 19% of referrals. And there was concern that kids were getting sent into the juvenile justice system and arrested in handcuffs by police for things like kicking a trash can, for having a plastic butter knife. That was one case in Florida. So these were extreme cases where I think often there was misunderstanding among police and among educators as to what the role should be, who should be handling that kind of discipline. And really there was a concern that policies that started after the Columbine mass shooting, that kind of spiraled out of control and became less about weapons and more about annoying behavior.
Hmm. And Judge Grohman, so you would see the effects of this, right? These kids before you. What did you see in your courtroom?
I saw young, very young children who were being sent to court for conduct that maybe 20 years ago would have been handled within the school, where a parent would have been called. Instead, I've had children as young as 9, 10, 11 years old brought to court for conduct that should have been handled within the school and community.
And what kind of conduct, for example?
Getting into school fights without serious injury, threatening teachers, pushing a teacher, playing in the playground and perhaps inappropriately touching another child. These are all activities that children engage in, not saying that they should go without any consequence, but to send them to juvenile court is overkill.
And were they primarily minority kids?
Yes.
And so then what would happen? What would you do? Would you have to mete out a punishment or could you dismiss the case?
Well, I tried to make sure that they were getting the supportive services that they needed, The problem is when cases come to court, they are so delayed. So some of these young people that I was seeing in court, the incidents occurred 6 months ago. And in between that time, some of these kids were out of school the entire time because they had suffered suspensions or expulsions and still did not get the services that they needed to support better behavior.
So this was supposed to kind of stem this so-called school-to-prison pipeline. And Susan, did you see any effects on it? I mean, I know it's only been a few years since these guidelines have been in place.
Well, I think that people are taking this a lot more seriously, and I think combined with these guidelines and then having to take a look at their own practices, that there have been some improvements and changes. I can tell you about some of the reporting I've done and I did out of Virginia. When we looked at the national data on these referrals to law enforcement, that state seemed to have the highest rate. And after we reported that and we looked at what some of the incidents were, a number of school districts changed their policies and the state really started taking it seriously. The legislature, including many Republicans, were on board to look at ways that they could use the legislative process to perhaps roll back some zero-tolerance type policies that may have been responsible for it. I mean, I can give you an example of one kid's story that really, I think, said a lot. He was a boy who was in sixth grade, and he was, not even an adolescent yet. And within the fall semester, he was cited for kicking a trash can, so the school resource officer gave him a ticket for that, which meant he had to go to court. And then he was suspended for talking up or not obeying instructions in class. And then when he came back from his suspension, he walked out of class without permission, and the school resource officer was asked to go get him. He grabbed this boy around the middle, and the boy is autistic. And the boy wriggled free and used some profanity, and then he ended up charged with felony assault on a police officer and disorderly conduct again. And he was ultimately threatened with being jailed. The school actually, took this seriously afterward, the school district, and they've changed their policies. And I found, too, talking with a lot of school resource officers and police departments, that they wanted to have changes because some of them were uncomfortable with what they were asked to get involved with. In Los Angeles, where I did some reporting, too, and I remember speaking with Judge Grohman, we reviewed tickets that the school police department was giving out to students, and there was a case of two first graders getting tickets because they were gotten a pushing match, and actually one of the parents insisted they get tickets, and the police department told me, well, we don't really like this, so we would like to have more guidelines.
Mm. Well, Judge Grohman, what do you think will happen if these guidelines are rescinded?
Well, you already see the effects of school discipline where young people are excluded from classroom situations. The dropout rate get higher. There are fewer high school graduates. There's more juvenile justice contact. And if you look at the folks that are in prison, there's a great majority of those people who have not graduated high school. So you can see that this has long-term effects.
So you do see the school-to-prison pipeline that I mentioned earlier?
Absolutely.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Judge Donna Quigley Grohman at the Los Angeles County Superior Court and Susan Ferris, investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Coming up, remembering Stephen Hawking and his connection to Southern California, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. One of the world's most famous scientists has died. Stephen Hawking passed away late last night at his home in Cambridge, England. He was 76. Well, not many physicists become famous, but Hawking became known the world over for his work on the universe and on black holes, and for doing all that in a wheelchair and unable to physically speak. When he was 22 years old, he was diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and he was just given a few years to live. But he obviously defied the odds and lived with the disease for more than 50 years. He couldn't move most of his body, and he used technology to speak.
I don't have much positive to say about motor neuron disease, but it taught me not to pity myself and to get on with what I still could do. I am happier now than before I developed the condition.
Well, despite his severe physical disability, his brain was clearly undiminished. Sean Carroll was one of Stephen Hawking's colleagues. He's a research professor of physics at Caltech, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks.
Well, we know Stephen Hawking as a genius, but tell us more about the kind of impact his work had in your field in particular.
Yeah, it was extremely impressive. I mean, Hawking is singular in the sense that he is an extraordinarily famous communicator of science, but he's also an extraordinarily accomplished scientist. He deserves all the credit he gets. His biggest contribution was asking what would happen in the vicinity of a black hole if you take into account quantum mechanics. Black holes are big space-time regions where gravity is very strong. Quantum mechanics is supposed to tell us what happens in very tiny regions. But Hawking realized that when you put them together, black holes ain't so black, as he liked to say it. They give off a little bit of radiation, but just enough that if you wait long enough, the black hole disappears entirely. That leaves us with puzzles that theoretical physicists today are still struggling with.
What are some of those puzzles?
Well, the biggest puzzle is the following. You throw a book into the black hole, and the black hole evaporates away. If you take Hawking's calculation at face value, what was in the book has no impact on the radiation that the black hole emits. So therefore, the information that was in the book is lost. And this bothers physicists for various reasons. They think that information should be conserved through time. So this is what's called the black hole information loss puzzle.
Huh, interesting. Well, didn't he also say that the black hole, because it's not so black, it's not necessarily a place where all things go to die forever, but that things and the black hole itself could be recycled through exploding outwards?
Yeah, that's right. So the stuff that you put in, the matter and energy, eventually comes out in the sense that the same amount of energy comes out in the radiation that goes in. It's this scrambling that really confuses us, because we have what Hawking did was predict a certain thing happening on the basis of two ideas: general relativity, Einstein's theory of space-time, and quantum mechanics, our theory of the subatomic world. Now, both of these theories say that information remains conserved as time goes on, and yet Hawking says when you put them together, maybe it's not. That's a big puzzle. Maybe he was right. Maybe information is not conserved, maybe only in the outside world. But one way or the other, it's the single most important clue we have in our attempts to reconcile quantum mechanics and gravity.
Tell us a little bit about what he thought regarding time travel.
Well, time travel is something where, of course, science fiction writers have thought about it for a long time. But once Einstein came along and said that space and time can curve into each other, you can wonder, could they curve so much that you hop in your rocket, zoom off, and then come back before you left to literally travel through a loop in time? And many physicists have wondered whether or not this was possible. And Hawking said, no, he doesn't think it is. So he proposed what's called the chronology protection conjecture, the idea that the laws of physics conspire to make it impossible to go backward in time.
Hmm. Okay, so he came to Caltech a lot, right? I mean, he sort of saw it as his second home.
Yeah, he did. Starting in the early 1990s, he spent a time every year here. He would hang out talking to the theoretical physicists and enjoying the California sunshine a little bit.
What was it like to work with him and be around him?
Well, as a young scientist, when I first met him, it was certainly extremely intimidating. You know, you knew what he had accomplished, and he was a big deal. And, of course, he talked very slowly. It took him time to type out words on his computer. So it was awkward because it's just not the social situation you're used to dealing with. He would ask a question, and you would answer, and then minutes would go by as he proposed the next question. So what that meant was that for him, every word really, really mattered. And interestingly, he used a lot of those words to make really bad jokes. He could not resist the temptations to be a wiseacre more often than not.
Would you socialize with him?
Oh, yeah. He was extremely social. I think that literally the first time I met him socially was at a whiskey tasting at a physics conference. This was a conference in the northern mountain region of England, the Lake District, and after the banquet, they organized a tasting of single malt scotches, and a bunch of physicists were there, and there was Stephen Hawking in the back of the room, his nurses letting him taste the single malts one by one, because Hawking would not, you know, compromise in how he lived his life. He would travel, he would enjoy life, he, you know, flew in the Vomit Comet, he was weightless for a little while, he experienced life to a greater degree than most of us who are fully able-bodied were ever able to do.
Yeah, and he even made a star turn on The Simpsons.
Your theory of a donut-shaped universe is intriguing, Homer. I may have to steal it.
Okay, so why do you think he became such, you know, not obviously a scientific icon, but also a cultural icon?
Well, I have to first mention that one of my personal contributions to world culture was I helped facilitate Stephen Hawking getting a guest appearance on The Big Bang Theory. Because I knew the producers of The Big Bang Theory, and they had trouble getting in touch with Stephen Hawking. Their emails were not being returned, but I knew how to get in touch with him. So without me, that might not have happened. I'm going to claim credit for that. And that's part of it, right? Part of it is his willingness to go out and be in the public eye, to write books. You know, it takes him an enormously long time to do anything. Writing a book is a fantastic challenge for anybody. And he wrote several books while still being an enormously productive scientist. His appearance on Star Trek, which even predates the appearance on The Simpsons, was mostly his idea. He thought it would be fun, and, you know, he knew he was Stephen Hawking. If he suggested it, they would probably go along with it.
So, yeah, and so his very embodiment of human potential and possibility, clearly an inspiration for
Yeah, you know, as he
world.
Says in the clip that you played, he did learn some lessons from being stricken with this disease, and he, in some weird way, flourished despite it, but probably not because of it, but, you know, he figured out a way to be extraordinarily successful with the condition that he had. And what is the excuse the rest of us have who don't have to put up with living in the wheelchair like that?
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
That's Sean Carroll. He's a research professor of physics at Caltech, and we've been remembering his former colleague, Stephen Hawking. Coming up, a one-man show that takes on the history of America in song, 246 songs, to be precise.
It was a British song, and the British would sing it to make fun of us because we were effeminate, you know, which is saying something coming from the British.
The history of Yankee Doodle Dandy and more, much more, in a 24-hour theater spectacle starring Taylor Mack. He'll be here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Imagine if RuPaul, David Bowie, Lucille Ball, and Lin-Manuel Miranda were in a musical about America, set in a cabaret bar, where the entire history of the United States is sung for 24 hours. Well, that's basically what theater artist and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient Taylor Mack offers up in his one-man show. It's called Taylor Mack, A 24-Decade History of Popular Music. A couple of years ago, he performed it in New York straight through. That is a marathon 24-hour-long show.
The audience was, they were deranged in their emotional availability. It was really fun. I'd never seen an audience like that before.
In Los Angeles, beginning tomorrow, Taylor Mack will perform the show, but on four separate nights, 6 hours long each.
Which has its own challenges for the audience and for us, but I think is kind of the sweet spot in terms of how to experience the show, because you get the duration, but you still get a good night's sleep.
This show is the history of the United States as told through song. 246 songs, to be precise, with a 24-piece orchestra.
Every decade has a song that people will know. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. The first decade has Amazing Grace in it, and Black is the Color of My Tulip's Hair. I was blind, but now I see. But then there's also songs in every decade that people won't know.
And Taylor wants audiences to consider a history that they might not know, a history that isn't taught in most textbooks.
I thought, well, why don't we just try to find out who that dandy is in Yankee Doodle Dandy? But the history is more kind of a happy accident of wanting to give the audience an experience of, oh, this is what's been on our backs for 200 and plus years, 242 years now. So what can we do with it, you know?
Well, who is that dandy in Yankee Doodle Dandy?
Well, I am the dandy. You are the dandy. I mean, we basically, that, you know, we're all the dandy in the Yankee Doodle Dandy. It's a funny story in that it was a British song, and the British would sing it to make fun of us because we were effeminate, you know, which is saying something coming from the British. And the song then became an American song because the Americans won a battle and they forced the British to dance, and they pointed their bayonets at them and made them sing Yankee Doodle over and over again. So it kind of became this anthem for Americans of, you know, it was taking back the the slur, as it were. So in a way, we're all the dandy.
Taylor Mack grew up as an outsider, gay, in Stockton, California in the 1980s.
It wasn't always the best place to be, but in some ways I think it helped me form a lot of my ideas about art and what I want to do with my life in terms of, and certainly this show in terms of, you know, building your community as a result of being torn apart. You know, my friends and I, we found each other because the environment surrounding us was so hostile.
He left Stockton and moved to New York, where he attended the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. He's classically trained, but he likes bending the rules, following the lead of his two favorite singers, Patti Smith and Nina Simone. He sings Simone's song, Mississippi Goddamn, when he gets to the 20th century in his 24-decade history of popular music.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air.
I wanted to do a Nina Simone song because she helped inspire the show. She has this quality of performing that is my favorite. It's, you know, when you combine virtuosity with vulnerability. And so sometimes she will sing off key, and that's because she's telling a story about inequality, and inequality isn't necessarily on pitch, or she's telling a story of heartbreak, and heartbreak isn't always on pitch. So she's willing to expose this part of her that is imperfect in order to get at a bigger truth. And And that's kind of what I wanted the core value of this particular show to be about. So we have the virtuosity of the orchestra and these incredible musicians, and I've memorized 246 songs, and I know what I'm doing as a theater artist. And at the same time, a show doesn't go by where we don't mess up. It's just a different way. You know, if you go to Broadway, you go see any major musician's concert, they have polished it to the point where the humanity is sometimes missing. Mm-hmm. And so we just try to bring a little bit of that humanity back in.
Just try to do my very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn.
And for Taylor Mack, bringing that humanity back in also requires audience participation. Taylor asks the audience to dance together, to play games together, to role play together.
Okay, so in order to really understand what it was like to live in the tenements, I'd like this part of the audience. You guys are all going to play the babies in the Jewish tenement, okay? And when I go like this, you're gonna make baby noises like meh, meh, meh. Okay, ready?
We can't do the show without the audience. So it's always different every single time we perform it. And that's because of how the audience responds and what happens with the audience. And there are moments where the entire audience does stuff together. So like beer, we play beer pong with the entire audience at one point, you know? So it's, you know, the drinkers all drink and then the non-drinkers have to play beer pong. So you know, it's like crazy stuff like that, which on the surface feels kind of like a shenanigan or, you know, some kind of gimmicky party trick or something like that. But actually in context to what we're dealing with in history and the way we do it in the show, there's a bit more profundity to it than just, you know, a party trick. So you can walk away from it just going, oh, that was fun, that was silly. Or you could actually kind of engage in it on a different level, which is has so much to do with the way bonds are made and communities are built and how these odd little things like drinking games are part of our history over and over and how they reflect the society at large in surprising ways.
The show is a one-man show, but the costumes Taylor wears may as well be characters too. He wears 24 of them, one for each decade.
More than Cher. Oh, I don't know. She probably has more per minute than I do. but yeah, our costume designer, Machine Dazzle, he's just a mad genius. And, you know, they're not really costumes. They're more works of art that I get to inhabit and live in. And he never stops designing, so... sometimes I'll walk on stage and he'll put a new headpiece on me that I've never worn before, you know, and it's like 10 seconds before I actually walk onto the stage.
Wow.
A couple times he's done it while I've been on stage. He just walks on and hands me something that I'm supposed to wear, you know, I've never worn it before.
I think we both always wanted to like maybe choreograph it a little bit more. It's hard because he's usually singing while we are changing. So there are some times where I have to hold off changing him just so that he can like get through a line. And then once we get to the chorus, it's like, okay, let's get it on during the chorus because that's the easy part. You know what I mean?
It brings a certain kind of liveness to the room that, especially for a durational piece, is necessary because it keeps everybody awake and, oh, what's going to happen next?
Usually it works and it's great. Sometimes there've been a few messy spots, but, you know, perfection is for assholes, so that's an ongoing theme throughout the whole show. Perfection is for assholes, and it is, and that means don't be to yourself.
There's always this sense of surprise lingering.
He has no requests. He trusts me to completely come up with something for him to wear for all of these, you know, decades, and so that's what I do. He completely trusts me.
Like when Machine Dazzle thought it best to dress Taylor Mack in a headdress of fabric hot dogs with a matching hoop skirt of sausages tied like barbed wire.
That is the Civil War decade costume. During that time, German immigrants on the streets started selling German sausages in, you know, slices of bread. And that's where the American hot dog kind of like that started the evolution. How fun. It's like it's like the original fast food, sort of. I don't know. I liked the story, so I used it. I don't even know if it's true. It doesn't matter. It's a great story. And it definitely visually it works.
Aside from fabric hot dog couture, Machine Dazzle makes Taylor Mex costumes out of 99-cent store party favors, fabrics found at secondhand stores, craft store feathers, wine corks, you name it. I asked Taylor if the costumes should be considered drag.
I mean, I call it drag, but that's primarily because, you know, if I didn't call it drag, then people would be offended.
So, who would be offended?
I mean, like other queens, you know, they'd be like, oh, you're too special to call yourself a drag queen, you know? So I'm a drag queen. I mean, it comes from drag, so many of the drag traditions. And yet it's very different from the kinds of drag that most people are used to seeing. So it's not female impersonation. It's more expression as citizenship. You know, I would say it's trying to express the full range of who I am on a stage. I tend to think when you're living in a culture where a salesman can become the president, it's maybe good to protest the tools of reduction, you know. So I'm just like trying to think of how can I be more expansive about the ways that I think about things and the art that we're making.
So I understand that you like to use a gender pronoun that is Judy, lowercase.
I do, yeah. I mean, I'm not a stickler to people using it. I think of it as a present, you know. If you want to use it, it's a present for you. It's fun. It makes people laugh. It makes people wonder. It makes you pause a little bit, which is, I kind of have a gender pronoun that works like a piece of art in the sense that art is there to kind of make you pause and rethink things. And so that's how I tend to use it, which doesn't mean that's how all gender pronouns are used. Some people really prefer it when you are very strict about your use and how you use it, and I respect that. But for me, it's I prefer it to be a little loosey-goosey.
So how would you use it, like in a sentence?
Well, I say, you know, we went and saw Taylor Mac. Judy was fabulous. You know? So it makes it sound like there's this person named Judy who's always hanging out with me and that she's better than me, which is kind of what I wanted.
After a particular Judy or just any old Judy?
After all the Judys.
All but the Judys.
Sure, you know, the major Judy, of course, Judy Garland. But really, just like in general, Judy is kind of both Punch and Judy. But, you know, the work I do really comes a lot from Commedia. But also, Judy, is like Mary, is a name that queers would use in order to pretend like they had a girlfriend. You know? So they would call their boyfriends, you know, oh Mary or oh Judy, you know, and so it was kind of a way of like signaling to the straight world that you were straight, even though of course it's the gayest thing in the world.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing you on stage.
Oh, super! Yeah, please come. It's going to be incredible. We're working with all these local performers, and we got an all female mariachi band that's joining us. We have a big old marching band that's joining us. We're really doing it out. We're exploding it.
Well, Taylor Mac, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Why even the beggar?
Not jump in the river and drink like a fish.
Taylor Mac, a 24-decade history of popular music, will be performed in four parts at the theater at the Ace Hotel beginning tomorrow. Coming up, MoCA fires its chief curator. Getty architect Richard Meyer is accused of sexual harassment. Those stories next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's talk now about some bad news that's hit a couple of local museums. MoCA downtown has fired its chief curator, Helen Molesworth. She was a big get for MoCA. She curated two of the museum's most popular shows lately, a 35-year retrospective of American painter Carrie James Marshall and another retrospective of Brazilian sculptor Ana Maria Maiolino. Also, architect Richard Meyer is accused of sexual harassment by five women. He designed the Getty Center, among many other buildings around the world, and now he's taking a six-month leave of absence. To talk about these stories, we have Carolina Miranda with us. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, and she's a regular contributor here on Press Play. Hi there.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, let's first talk about Helen Molesworth, chief curator at MoCA for the last three or so years. Tell us more about her and her vision.
Well, she is a curator who came to Los Angeles from the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston, with a pretty big reputation. I think she was an important get for Los Angeles at the curatorial level, and a scholar who was really devoted to rewriting the history of art in the sense of making sure that it was more inclusive of women in particular. She's a feminist art historian, as well as people of color. That, you know, there are many stories of art history, and it's usually one story that gets told. And I think Helen was very dedicated to the idea that part of her job was to look at what had been overlooked.
Okay, so apparently Helen Molesworth clashed with the director of MoCA, Philippe Verne. What were the disagreements about?
I think some of it came up last month when it was announced that MoCA was going to be shelving its gala. The artist Mark Grochon, who was scheduled to be honored at the gala, he's a very important Los Angeles painter, ended up withdrawing his name from the gala, saying that what MoCA really needed to do was be honoring somebody else, that he would have represented the third white male artist, straight white male artist in a row that the museum was honoring. And as part of that news, the board member Larry Pittman ended up resigning from the board. And Larry is a part Colombian painter. He's Latino. He is also gay. He came out in the 1970s. And he said that he felt that the museum was not really as devoted to issues of inclusion and diversity as they might be paying lip service to. And as part of it, he said that he felt that there were these intractable conflicts between the board, the museum's directorship, which would be Philippe Verne, and the curatorial, which was led by Helen. Mm-hmm. And so I think his interview really gave the sense that you had all of these different power factions at play, and it seems that none of them were in agreement about what the focus of the museum should be.
Well, and that's been a problem for a while now. So MoCA's been in trouble for quite some time, financially and curatorially, apparently. So when Jeffrey Deitch left, they hired Philippe Verne, and people were hoping that this would calm the troubled waters. So give us a quick history of why MoCA is so troubled.
This dates back to the Jeremy Strick era, who was the director before Jeffrey Deitch was the director. At that point, the museum, they were spending down the endowment to put on all of these shows. And it reached this point where MoCA was practically broke. And Eli Broad came in with, it was something like a more than $30 million cash infusion to help save the museum, which was on the brink of insolvency. And at that time, Jeremy Strick left, and Broad and a contingent of board members brought in Jeffrey Deitch, who was a museum director who didn't have any museum experience. His experience was in the gallery world in New York. He ran an eponymous gallery there, was known for being a real scenester. And I think the feeling was like, oh, if we bring in someone from the business side, it will help kind of clear up MoCA's troubles. We'll bring in somebody financially savvy. But it didn't clear up MoCA's travails. And I think part of that was because being a museum director is a very specific job that is really about fundraising. A good museum director is constantly working the phones for money, cultivating new sources of donations, potentially exploring new board members, developing new programs. And that did not happen after Deitch. And so then Philippe came in. So it's been this little bit of a musical chairs of museum directors there trying to right that ship. But, you know, now with Helen's dismissal, the big question is what's happening over there and who's going to want to be chief curator at the museum now?
Yeah, big, big open question and a big problem for this museum. Meanwhile, across the street, Eli Broad has his own museum full of his own art. That seems
exactly.
to be doing okay.
It's doing quite well. I mean, they've been getting blockbuster crowds over there. But, you know, Eli doesn't have to focus on the issues of fundraising that MoCA does.
Right.
The museum is self-funded, and so he's not dialing for dollars. MoCA's right. in a very different position.
I mean, he is on the board still?
He remains on the board, and there
Can he just cut a check? Help them out.
I think, you know, people, part of the issue, I think, with MoCA's history is, you know, it's always like, what is the easy solution here? And you can always look to a board member to cut the check. But I think all of this raises questions about the board's stewardship of the museum dating back to the Strick era, you know, what happened after Strick left and after the museum was in a point of insolvency is that a lot of the same board members that had sort of seen the spending down of the endowment remained on the board, and some of them remain on the board as life trustees. Eli is a life trustee. Maria Reina Bell is a life trustee. There's a number of folks there that have been there throughout all of this stuff. And I think this is about having a board that is committed to the vision of what that museum is. And what that museum started off as is that this would be a museum that would represent the artists of Los Angeles. So the question is the board fulfilling its mission in the types of hires it's making, the types of galas it's throwing, and in all of the activities it pursues?
Okay, let's move on to the Getty. And its starchitect, the designer of the museum, Richard Meyer, now accused of multiple counts of sexual harassment. Is this finally the Me Too movement coming to the architecture world?
This is the Me Too movement coming to the architecture world, and it's actually a little surprising that it hasn't happened sooner. The dynamics of the architecture world as such, it is incredibly macho, and if you look at the statistics of the American Institute of Architects, only 18% of registered architects with the AIA, which is the main national organization, are women. If you look at things such as the Pritzker Prize, which is what they call architecture's Nobel, it has overwhelmingly gone to men. Since it was created in 1979, only three women have won the prize, and only one lone woman has won the prize. The other women who've won the prize have done so as part of group practices, mm-hmm. group firms. Only Zaha Hadid, the Iraqi-born architect, she's the only woman to win a Pritzker on her own. A number of years ago, there was a story of Denise Scott Brown, who with her husband, Robert Venturi, a very well-known postmodern architect, he was awarded a Pritzker for their practice and she was not. And there were questions of how does architecture recognize women in the field? And it raised a lot of issues about how women are treated. And I ended up doing a long interview with her in which she told me about how she was treated, that, you know, oftentimes he would get invited to events, but not her because there would be no wives. It didn't matter that she was a wife who happened to be an architect as well, that, you know, men would verbally accost her for demanding more rights in the field. It's a very macho, very sexist field. And so the Meyer allegations, to some degree, it's not surprising that that could occur within the field of architecture.
Ironic, though, that he supported her. He stuck up for her.
He did stick up for her, as did a number of other male architects. So the question is, you know, who's harboring a few skeletons in the closet there? I guess it's easy to sign a petition, but how committed are these firms truly to bringing up women in their ranks, to making them partners, and to heeding their design ideas, which ultimately is where the power lies?
Carolina Miranda writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Christian Bordahl is here now with some
there, Madeline.
Feedback. Hi.
So thousands of school students out protesting gun violence and gun control today. So we asked our listeners whether they thought the students' efforts might actually make any difference. And Martin Lucas says yes, the protests will change the young people that participate in them. They'll become more engaged, more capable of mounting a group action, more critical, and more of a political force. LJ Fogel says, I think it's great that these kids are out there. What some people fail to realize is that as they cling to their guns, the government is disarming us in other ways, mostly economically. Craig Loudon says, oh, please, I don't need to be told what to do, especially by some ignorant kids slash political animals. Being necessary to a free state, he's quoting the Second Amendment, means just that. And then we have Wade Specht saying, why is it that airports, sporting events, concerts, county fairs, and courthouses have security at their entrances, but schools don't? Tammy Smith says, the difference is that all those places have money, and taxpayers don't want to spend money on education.
All right. A variety of opinions, always welcome. Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.